You are listening to Radio Maria Canada, a Catholic voice wherever you are. We now present Ask the Lawyer, hosted by Joe Martinello.
Thank you, Nick. It's Joe Martinello in the studios of Radio Maria, Radio Maria, if you wish, here in Toronto. Welcome to all of our listeners. This is our first broadcast after the summer pause in September. The fall has started, and we're here at Radio Maria to retake what we hope are programs during the year that will be of interest to you. Prior to the summer break, had done a number of programs in English related to a number of areas of the law, which we think you found valuable. And we're going to return to start off this year, this broadcast year, dealing with the themes of citizenship and immigration again, because it's been quite a few months and there's been a lot of developments in the past few months that we know have been of interest. And of course, immigration continues in particular to be a theme of incredible, we'll call it not only importance, but newsworthy. And it's important to understand the context of so many of these things that are occurring. In this way, we also encourage any of our listeners who have any comments or questions to ask about the area. We're always happy to listen to comments and questions and see if we can dialogue in some manner and certainly provide a more educational experience for all of you. So here in English, in the English stations, if anyone has any comments who listens to us, practically speaking, across North America, technically because we broadcast even on an internet platform, it's technically available around the world, but particularly in North America. And it's area code 416, which is the area code in Toronto, 416. And the phone number is 245-1534. Again, the number to call in if anyone has a comment or a question, area code 416. 2451534. The news of the past month here in Ontario has been headlined by something that you might say, well, you think it has nothing to do with immigration and citizenship, but in principle, it has everything to do with what we've talked about over the years, and that had to do with the introduction by the Conservative government of Ontario of a law to essentially create a smaller number of city councillors that would accord with the federal ridings in Toronto area, and basically having the number of city councillors who make decisions for the city of Toronto. And of course, a lot of people think it's just about politics or not or whatever, but What I thought was really interesting when you have the different things that were occurring. The judge found that it was contrary to the Canadian Constitution, and we've often said that even in the context of citizenship and immigration, the ground zero, the baseline for understanding everything that happens in the news, you have to understand constitutional law. And you'd say, well, you're not a lawyer and so on, but the basics are good enough to understand to appreciate some of the arguments that are presented. So, for example, what was said by the Conservative government, which is constitutionally true, is that the City of Toronto exists at the pleasure, at the behest, as they used to say, of the provincial government. And why? Because we have a Canadian constitution that divides powers or devolves powers between a federal and a provincial level. And in certain areas, like municipal governments, the federal government has absolutely really no constitutional role. In other words, the government of Canada does not decide that there should be a City of Toronto. This is all governed by provincial law. And because it is, they call it a creature of statute. In other words, it only exists at the pleasure of the provincial government. And we actually saw this in action when the Premier for Ontario introduced a change, and a lot of people felt it was very unfair, not necessarily that they were opposed to it, so close to the municipal elections. And so what occurred was that a judge in the Superior Court of Ontario said, no, you can do this, but you breach people's rights because it's way too close to the election to be able to do things properly and allow people to run and voice their democratic preferences. That went to the federal, to the Ontario. In the meantime, what occurred, and this is where it becomes important again to understand the clause, it was the province tried to use or had proposed to introduce what they called the notwithstanding clause. I can guarantee you that about 99% of all people in Ontario had absolutely no idea what this notwithstanding clause meant, because it's an old word that sometimes only lawyers use. But in fact, once again, it's very important to understand the Canadian Constitution. And the Canadian Constitution, when it was created, it essentially said that even if a law is unconstitutional, a province can use its rights to override that lack of constitutionality, and it and then for a period of 5 years they can basically override it. And this was a great political compromise, and I think it's best to understand it in that context. It was a great political compromise when the Canadian Constitution was repatriated at the time of the late Premier Trudeau, with the concurrence of all the provinces except for Quebec. Quebec still has not formally approved the constitutional changes. But at that time, it was deemed constitutional by the Supreme Court of Canada. What had occurred, the Canadian Constitution was repatriated from England. And in fact, the Canadian Charter of Rights was embedded into the Canadian Constitution, as we call it today. And so the Canadian Constitution has a series of checks and balances. We should all be familiar with checks and balances, because if a lot of us are watching the drama that is unfolding to the south of us in the United States with the nomination hearings of the Supreme Court of the United States nominee, Mr. Justice Kavanaugh, we, depending perhaps on what we think of politics, we are either shaking our heads or laughing as to what is occurring down south. But you see these situations of checks and balances being played out, even in the United States, where their nominees to the Superior Court have to be approved, nominated by the president, but have to be approved by the American Senate. So in Canada, from a constitutional perspective, we have this notwithstanding clause. So this notwithstanding clause was threatened and was proposed to be used by the Premier of Ontario to override whatever lack of constitutionality occurred. And what is interesting about all this is the Court of Appeals said, basically, that although Premier Ford's legislative attempt in trying to what they call gerrymander. It's a funny English word, but basically changed Toronto's election law. It was disruptive, and it did reduce the effectiveness of the messages that any candidate would want to make, notwithstanding, as a joke, one could say, their political views. And the Court of Appeal decision actually said that there was a very strong inference that the bill was actually unfair, but they said that unfairness does not make the law unconstitutional. And this is very, very important to understand. Why? Because, again, the provincial law is what governs with respect to municipal governments. It's not something embedded in our constitution. If municipal governments are not at the table, they don't decide, and they have never decided what the constitution will or will not say, which, by the way, is exactly the same position. People may find it hard to understand, but it's actually the same position with many of the indigenous groups or native or first Canadian people. They're actually not a deciding party to the Canadian constitution, although their rights are embedded therein, just as the rights to Catholic education in Ontario is also embedded in the constitution. But we're not a party. There's no such thing as, it's not like the Catholic Church or the representatives of the Catholic Church have a seat to make constitutional changes. All their rights are contained in them. And so the Ontario Court of Appeal decided that even though the law may be unfair, it's not unconstitutional. And they didn't say definitively that the judge, who was Mr. Justice Bellababa, actually was wrong when he found Bill 5, which is the law that the province had submitted to reduce the number of councillors, City of Toronto City Council, had violated the charter. But they found that there was a strong likelihood that was an error. And so this is what occurred, and this whole use of the notwithstanding clause was completely avoided. Now you say, well, why is that important? It's important because when the notwithstanding clause was first introduced and the Canadian Constitution was repatriated, it was used many, many times in Quebec in order to preserve French language rights, where there were cases that were determined to be discriminatory, according to some very technical issues relating to language rights. And the Quebec government said, we don't care, we're going to override it with our laws because we need to preserve the French language. And so it was used a lot by Quebec, and it was deemed to be, you know, from a legal's perspective, to be a very heavy-handed type of thing. Because if you were to talk to all the people who were the premiers at the time and so on, it was not designed to be the flavor of the month that you used whenever you wanted to. It was really designed to be used for major important issues. And in fact, aside from the initial period when it was used a lot by Quebec, it has not been used very much at all since then. Most recently, it was used, believe it or not, in Saskatchewan. And those of us here who listen to Catholic radio would be very interested to know that the Saskatchewan government funds Catholic education. And similar to Ontario, it particularly funds Catholic education in high schools, which are open to all people. And this is maybe something that people don't understand. But in Ontario, in the Catholic high school system, you do not have to be Catholic to attend the Catholic high school. You have to, you perhaps may have to take religion as a course. You may have to follow a lot of the things. Nobody forces you to, to pray to Jesus or to even attend the Mass or whatever. But you can attend the Catholic system. That's very interesting from an ethical point of view. And we know that here in Toronto, there are a number of other faiths who, in fact, choose to send their children to the Catholic high school system. And in particular, I'm aware of a number of people who are Seventh-day Adventists, which is a Protestant sect, and they send their kids. Why? Because they feel the Catholic system rightly or wrongly, we don't have to debate that today, but the Catholic school system offers a moral aspect to education that the public system does not offer. And in fact, there are even a number of people who adhere to the Muslim faith who send their children to Catholic high schools. All of this you may find very surprising, but it's the reality. In Saskatchewan, it's not unlike that. And so what happened was there was a constitutional challenge brought that went as far as the Saskatchewan Court of Appeal, I believe, and they said, yes, the government of Saskatchewan cannot fund in Saskatchewan Catholic education in high schools, not for Catholics they can do, but not for people who are not Catholic. Of course, you can appreciate this would create a great financial issue. And the province of Saskatchewan stepped in and said, thank you very much. We understand it. But we think this is the provision of education, which is our obligation and right under the Constitution, is too important to be met by that argument. We're going to allow funding of Catholic high schools, even for people who are not Catholic who attend it, because it's important for the integrity of the system. So that's one of the very few times it was used recently. And Premier Ford seemed to think that it was important enough, the size of the city of Toronto, to use this very, very major tool available in the arsenal of the provincial government to do that. And it was very interesting from another perspective, because many of you may not know that the former Prime Minister Mulroney, who, of course, was very instrumental in a number of legal initiatives, including the North American Free Trade Agreement, which we also know is being widely debated and so on, and being dealt with both on both sides of the border. His daughter, Caroline Mulroney, is the Ontario Attorney General. And there were a lot of comments that were not very charitable towards her, rightly or wrongly, about not supporting the rule of law. And you know, we lawyers support the rule of law. And I think it's fair to say that 80 to 90% of all lawyers felt that the actions that were perhaps going to be finalized by the current government were really, really excessive. And I guess we can, and everyone was surprised that someone like Caroline Mulroney, whose father, of course, was the premier and was a great supporter of the Constitution. Matter of fact, during this whole debacle, I call it a debacle because I think it showed a very dark side to how we treat these very important issues. And he actually tweeted that he felt that it was a not a proper use. And it's interesting because, once again, his daughter is the Attorney General, and I oftentimes thought that she should take counsel for her father. We know that the Section 92 of the Constitution Act makes it clear that the province has exclusive jurisdiction over municipalities. Many people felt that they should just have played it out and let the thing go and change the law, and that would have been it. So it was a very hasty decision. It brought out the nasty side of people. And unfortunately, the current premier said that he wouldn't hesitate to make that threat again. So we get into the situation of bully politics and rule of law. And whether you're on the left or on the right, I always say to people, be careful for what you wish for. Because if you think that, for example, the particular government in power today is wonderful and what they're doing is wonderful, and they use methods that are, from my perspective, do not follow the rule of law, you have to realize that in our democratic system, what goes around comes around. And one day, if you are of a particular persuasion, in a couple of years later, the other political persuasion could be there to do exactly the same thing. So I don't think it's the proper way to do things. I think in a civil society, There has to be discourse and respect for the law, and you don't use heavy-handed tools for things that are not of great importance. So that is what occurred. You might say, well, Joe, what's the municipal government got to do with immigration and citizenship? Well, it outlines exactly how immigration and citizenship is part of our Constitution, but it's not a unilateral power. And this is, once again, something that perhaps you could say that I've been preaching, but it's very, very clear, and it came out in these discussions, that the powers relating to immigration are a divided responsibility. They're divided between the province and the federal government. It's one of the very few areas in our Constitution where that occurs, and it's very important to understand the nuances and how things work from that perspective. And it's not like citizenship, because citizenship, like the creation of the criminal law is federal, and the enforcement of the criminal law in almost all aspects is done on the provincial level. So these are the pluses and the minuses that we see, and they're important because they interact with each other. So citizenship, again, is an aspect of the federal government, not the provincial government. The provincial government does not decide who is a citizen of Canada. The federal government does. And so that is an area of exclusive jurisdiction, just as the creation of municipal governments are. And some of you may have seen also during the summer months that with respect to the passports, which again are not a matter of a right, they flow from the citizenship law, that there was access provided. And as all of you may have known, that Canadians today, now compared to 5 years ago, pay anywhere from $120 to $160 for an adult passport. And it costs about $70 to produce it. And the government has actually made over $1 billion in the last 4 years with the new passports. That is certainly under attack. But the new passports have been over a 10-year period. And that, once again, passports relate to citizenship law and are a matter of federal concern. So what we're going to do, we're going to take a small break. And when we come back, I'm going to go more into the immigration aspect and talk about some of the issues that have happened during the summer relating to immigration, both on a federal and provincial level, because it's a matter of joint jurisdiction that I think you'll find interesting.
You are listening to Radio Maria Canada, a Catholic voice wherever you are. We now continue with the program, Ask the Lawyer, hosted by Joe Martinello.
Thanks, Nick. Back in the Radio Maria studios, talking about Canadian immigration, citizenship, and constitutional matters today. There was one point that I felt that I should mention again before I move into the immigration section, because it was in the papers, and lawyers like to use obscure sometimes issues, and somebody will say, my goodness, this notwithstanding clause is so complicated. And we've tried to simplify a little bit by pointing out to you that it's a way that a province can override a law that might even be unconstitutional in certain areas. We won't go into the technical details, but there are certain rights that you cannot do that on. But this was certainly one of them. But there's also another section of the old Constitution Act is called the dissolution's disallowance power. And what it is, it goes back to an old federal case that said that the federal government has a disallowance power, and it enables them to effectively override any law. And that is something of great interest, that was, let's say, the disallowance power, which would have, simply put, under the Constitution, would have allowed the federal cabinet to disallow any act of a provincial legislature. In other words, Ottawa could have, in simplistic terms, simply disallowed Premier Ford's council-chopping legislation, notwithstanding the use of the notwithstanding clause. How about that? And so you think, why didn't he use it and so on? And Prime Minister Trudeau had said, no, I'm not going to do it. It's not of such importance that I'm going to use that kind of a heavy-handed power to disallow a provincial law. And in fact, the last time it's been used is in 1930. So it's been like over 75 years. The political consequences can be very severe. So now you have a better understanding of what could occur. And I think that the temperament displayed by Prime Minister Trudeau was the correct decision, because at the end of the day, the number of councillors for the City of Toronto is not the most earth-shattering event that will occur in our daily lives. But in any event, and it certainly wasn't unconstitutional. So during the summer, we're moving into the immigration section, which is an area of joint federal and provincial jurisdiction. I wanted to highlight a number of issues that have been occurring that are all of importance, because in previous segments, we've talked about the complexity of the law. And we see, of course, immigration is very important to us because we roughly have 325,000 to 350,000 people who come to Canada every year with legal immigration. Canada, again, chooses who wants to come here. The country is not being invaded by refugees, counter to to what the newspapers and, display is. We might see in places like Italy and Greece and Spain, large number of people arising. In Canada, number of refugees are always around the 25,000 range. They're coordinated a lot of times with the United Nations High Commission for Refugees, roughly 50% of them. Although we now have an issue dealing with people who are, of course, were in the United States for many years or have come to the United States and are fleeing even the United States, but they're not entering into Canada at a border crossing. They're entering into it a non-border crossing, because the situation is that the law is, that stands right now, is that if you enter the border crossing, I'm making it very simple, but you enter the border crossing and you entered the United States first, you should be doing a refugee application in the United States and vice versa with Canada. But the way the law was created, it's what happens at a port of entry. And a port of entry are those official places that we know, like Buffalo, Niagara Falls, New York, Gananoque, in Vancouver. There are certain places. There are actual official places where if you go from Canada to the U.S. or vice versa, that there's border officers and so on. But, of course, the border is thousands of kilometers long, and there are people who are trying to cross it to enter to actually avoid the application of that security law that we have in Canada. So this is something that I think will be of great interest to all of us as we're looking ahead, because a lot of people are saying to the existing government in power in Ottawa, what are you doing? You're encouraging a disrespect of the law. It should not make any difference whether you try to enter Canada from the United States at a port of entry or border crossing or through an informal place. And, you know, and so there's a great discussion about whether this should be occurring or not. And, of course, that tailors exactly into the, believe it or not, the NAFTA discussions, because we are seeing played out this great drama in the different negotiating positions, Canada, United States, and Mexico, with NAFTA, which is hugely important on both sides of the border, and which we would probably will devote some attention to in the near future when we get maybe closer to, hopefully, to an agreement between the parties. But you can see how it's all, it is all so interrelated, not just on a personal, but on an economic basis. And part of that has to do with security, and part of that has to do with how refugees are handled. And all of these issues that are of, say the least, are of some importance to us all. So these are going to be other themes. So you can understand now when the press talks about people entering the border, some of you'd be scratching your heads. You said, "Well, I thought we had an agreement between Canada and the United States relating to border security and people making refugee claims." And the answer is we do, but the law is not perfect. And it'll be interesting to see the discussions that go on between the various political forces about what we should or should not be doing in terms of treating and dealing with these people who have been in the United States, many cases, for many years, but feel threatened by the current political government and whether they should be allowed to make a refugee claim. Another issue that has come out, which is of extreme importance for those of us in the field of law, and it relates a lot to our humanitarian, compassionate view of the world. You've heard me joke before that our humanitarian, compassionate law is not very humanitarian and compassionate in many ways. And one of the ways that they weren't compassionate and humanitarian would be for people who could legally come to Canada in many cases. But, for example, they would have a child or a spouse who would have a particular disability, in particular in the medical field. So we have all these things relating to medical inadmissibility. It's a very complicated field, I must tell you. It's a very complicated field. And the government had set up this, for want of a better word, they said, look, if you're bringing your mother or father over from Italy and they're diabetic, well, you know, let's look at their medical condition and determine if they are an excessive demand. Those are the magic words, an excessive demand. And there's a very complicated formula relating to how much money would have to be spent on that person with respect to the medical condition and whether it exceeds the average five-year expenditure of a person of his type, of a Canadian in general, I should say, not of his age, for example. And if you're over the magic figure, then you're in excessive demand, and therefore we're not going to let you come to Canada. So this is a matter of some importance because many people who come to Canada would like to bring their parents down the road to come and live with them in Canada. Those of us who are here in the Italian community, of course, are very, very aware of many, many parents and grandparents who came to live here in Canada. This is a very normal part of the immigration stream, but which is extremely limited. For example, the government in its generosity actually increased the number to 10,000, 15,000. Before it was only 5,000 persons who could come in that category. And there are a lot of people who make a very good argument that we should not be bringing people who are parents or grandparents of people who have immigrated to Canada, because older people tend to use medical care more extensively than other people. And therefore, they chew up and use up the medical infrastructure dollars that we have for all of us. And this is, and then perhaps we're being too generous in having a program that allows parents and grandparents to come into Canada. Now, I should let you know that in the United States, this has never been an issue. You could always bring in parents and grandparents. There were numerical caps that were much higher than Canada. But in the United States, until very recently, there was also no medical health care coverage for most people, so therefore it was less of an issue. But in any event, this is another great political discussion that you will see going on, which, by the way, medical admissibility has nothing to do with the provinces. It's in the Federal Immigration Act. There is not a single province that has stepped into this medical inadmissibility issue, although the provinces are actually responsible for administering health care across Canada. So you will see that there's differences in health care across Canada because, once again, it's a provincial jurisdiction that, in terms of its administration. What's most important to understand, and it made the papers literally a week ago, it was just an announcement because the federal government felt that the dollar figure was too low, and there were a bunch of legal cases that were challenging it. And what they did was they increased to 2018. They said, no, we're going to be more humanitarian. That's the way they had phrased the language. The new cost threshold for the five-year period is going to be $99,000. So that means, as I just mentioned to you, which is $19,812 per year, that means that what they're going to do so that this excessive demand calculation has not been eliminated. It was sort of announced in like a press release that the federal government was getting rid of an excessive demand calculation. And it might have been, I don't know if it was somebody talking excessively or just emotionally or whatever, but I think somebody woke up and said, well, no, we can't allow somebody to sponsor a parent who has a severe cancer condition that will cost, $500,000 to come in, and we have people here that can't get treatment. So I think the idea was that we become a bit more humanitarian and compassionate and get rid of this old $5,000 or $6,000 a year limit, and we bring it up to almost a $20,000 a year threshold. So that's the new law. It's by regulation. It just got announced. And quite frankly, you didn't hear much talk about it on any of the political parties. Maybe it's too hot a political potato. So as you go from 7 to 20, you know, nobody wants to be seen to be an ogre. But anyways, it's become a little bit more generous. And this is important because we often have clients who are sponsoring their parents and so on. And they're a little bit concerned about the medical condition, and it's always an area of concern. But certainly the $20,000 a year limit certainly gets rid of a lot of issues that can be problematic. Most people whose parents have diabetes, because as you know, I mean, everywhere in the world, there's people have cholesterol, diabetes, and other issues. And this will be something that that needs to be looked at. And if parents, of course, have or grandparents have medical conditions, you have to be aware of it when a sponsorship application is being made. The rules have changed. We are no longer having a lottery system. That's been removed. It's going back to a system where you make an application. That will probably be instituted January, February this year. We're looking forward to the new rules because the numbers are limited. Even if there's 15 or 20,000 people, there'd probably be 40 or 50,000 . Some people even say 100,000 applications for people to bring parents and grandparents in under this kind of a sponsorship. There will be a cap. The question will be, how do we do it in a fair way? A lot of people were complaining that even the lottery system, which is at random, was not fair because, you know, people who've maybe been here for more years should be treated better or not than people who have just arrived. And it was a very arbitrary way. So we're going to see how the government tries to deal with that issue of who's going to be able to be sponsored. And it'll be very interesting, and we'll probably comment further on in the year when we get more details. But that's something that has definitely changed. In the area of other kinds of immigration processing, things like visa work, federal work programs, you heard that many people in this field and lawyers talk about the Canadian Processing Center, Vagreville. It's become almost an English word in Alberta. Vagreville is going to close. It's closed. It's moving to Edmonton. Everything in terms of internal processing in Canada since September the 2nd is going to be in Edmonton, Alberta. They've closed down the government offices in Vagreville, Alberta, which was in northern Alberta. Everything will be going to Alberta. So that's a practical change that you'll see in the papers. The other thing that you'll see now is, and which is, of course, becomes a big part of our immigration because Canada chooses who comes here. And it's quite an interesting or difficult, I'll call it, bureaucratic process. And that's going to have to do with what they call the Foreign Worker Program. And there have also been some changes that have been announced. And this will be very important for any of our listeners who have family members in other countries or maybe who are employers or people who are even here on work permits and they're hoping somehow to be able to parlay their work permit into a landed immigrant visa. And so there are certain changes that are being proposed that were going to be interesting. And it'll make some of them important because, for example, on the area of employers, because we see many more employers who are finally getting the sense that maybe there is a process where there is a genuine shortage in demand for skilled workers, skilled people, and there is a great shortage in many areas. And we all know that the unemployment rate here in Canada is quite low. Property values seem to have stabilized again. Younger people are finding jobs. Of course, most of the immigration that comes to Canada every year, the 300,000 plus people, most of those people are much younger people who speak English or French fairly well or have a trade that is in demand. So this is the movement that is happening in Canada. It's going to happen in the next 20 years because of the low birth rate, which is below the magic number of 2.2 as we move from 36, 37 million people to a Canadian population of 60 million. This is something that no political party is really going to stop. And so the federal government, since December 2015, there were amendments to the federal immigration regulations that, for example, allowed this government entity called Employment and Social Development Canada to pose penalties on non-compliant employers on a scale. And this is to ensure honesty and integrity to the system. And they also could find themselves banned from using the foreign worker programs for anywhere from 1 to 10 years, with even a permanent exclusion for very serious offenders. And so the government, what they've done is they've been stepping up their inspection regime to see what was happening, and they're going to be really trying to control employers more. And the comments have been made in the past that employers were getting away with murder, but now we have a system that's got checks and balances, and where the employers now have certain liabilities, and so This really requires employers to really, really not what I call, say, play games with the Canadian immigration system, because it encourages a disrespect for the rule of law. And this is what, you know, lawyers like to say, but it's true. So, you know, where people were being penalized very little money and so on, they would just be helping somebody out. And some people felt that maybe they were taking money under the table or they were just helping out their buddies. And in the meantime, that means that people who have genuine skills and genuine abilities were not able, to do that. So this is a change that's happened that will make, in fact, compliance a much more serious issue. And we are telling all of our employers who want to bring in the people what they want to do. But I must tell you that most of the employers I find want to do things right. They still find it quite a challenging situation. And so this is certainly something that probably is a little bit more severe, but provides balances. On the provincial side, what we see very recently, just announced a couple of days ago, and I'm actually looking at it, that Ontario revised what they call the comprehensive ranking system. So you will remember that in our immigration system for skilled workers, we have this pool of people. You know, this is where you dive into this pool, and it's called express entry, and you create this profile, and then you see what your point situation is, and then depending on what the government announcements are, they issue you an invitation to apply. And under the new rules that were also changed during the summer, you don't have 90 days anymore now. You have 60 days to prepare a complete application and send it in. I will tell you, as a lawyer who's practiced almost 40 years in this field, it is a marathon to get everything together on the 60-day platform. And as a matter of fact, many of our clients who are going into the express entry pool, hoping to get fished out of the pool in the future, we are already getting all the documentation in the background that's necessary because we don't have 90 days anymore. We have 60 days. And so if they get picked, they have to be ready to act right away. So this comprehensive ranking system now is down what we call the 400 level. And what happened, what the Ontario government did, is they decided that they waived the minimum of 403 draws this year, two of which were targeted express entry candidates with a job offer in Ontario, and another one that was targeted with people who have French language abilities of what we technically call 7.0 or higher. This is somebody who speaks French at a medium to high level. Now, the reason is, again, and it's been repeated and I repeat it, is statistically the studies have come out this summer that have proven that people who speak English and French tend to earn more money than people who are monolingual. And that means they pay more taxes. Let's be very blunt about it. So, of course, the government wants people to come here and work and take jobs where they can earn more money and pay more taxes. And it's just a statistical reality. So we see this happening. And Ontario even dropped the comprehensive ranking system as low as 350 on August the 9th. So as you can see, this is an area of immigration on the Ontario side where Ontario is exercising its constitutional authority and right to try to choose more people for the benefit of the Ontario economy. And so what we see is that this is occurring more and more. We're seeing more and more people that are going to be eligible for this criteria. And in fact, a lot of our clients are now trying to consider whether they're going to apply federally or, for example, in Ontario, in order to come to Canada. And so it's good news for people who are working here, who are here, who want to work, and they're wondering about the long-term perspectives. It seems like we're getting a little bit more flexibility to get people who are able to get work permits to stay here and work and become landed immigrants of Canada, which is good news for them. And it's good news for us because, once again, we're choosing the people that are really needed in our economy. So that's the we're gonna close the program for today because we've tried to highlight a whole bunch of small but important changes that are really important in people's daily lives. We see, for example, as I said, Ontario is taking these kinds of steps. They're even going to do a Northern Ontario immigration program because everybody realizes that a lot of the smaller cities are being depopulated, and we have to see if there are measures to encourage people to go to cities other than Ottawa, Montreal, and Vancouver. So these are all issues that you'll see and you can understand from a constitutional perspective are so important in terms of how the country grows. It's a small part of the overall picture. So we're going to terminate our talk on immigration and citizenship today. And we hope you all have a great weekend, and we'll pass everything back to Nick in the studio of Radio Maria in Toronto.
You have been listening to Ask the Lawyer, hosted by Joe Martinello. Here on Radio Maria Canada, a Catholic voice wherever you are.